I went to operate school, and I always went accompanied by fellow schoolboys. It's quite a, in London, it's quite a common thing. I mean,
was it a good period of the, I mean, opera in
20s?
England? 20s? Yes, in England. I mean, the standard.
There was 2 months in the summer at Covent Garden, yeah, with great national singers there. Otherwise, nothing. I mean, the Carl Rosa Opera Company, which was third rate, but which was better than nothing. Better than nothing. A lot of people, as somebody said, a lot of miners' wives whistled tunes afterwards. So it did some good.
I thought that opera ought either to be perfect or not at all, because when opera is not excellent, something is...
No, I don't think.
I know you don't think
I
so.
Think that...
You are more tolerant. I don't know why.
Chesterton once said, if a thing is worth doing at all, it's worth doing badly.
Now coming back, we'll come to the opera, but early maturity, I mean...
I think so. I think when I came to Oxford in 1928, I was not terribly different what I am now. I think I was always somewhat middle-aged, probably. I doubt if I had a kind of real childhood, real youth. I had a very happy childhood, but I think I was an only child. We didn't grow up with other children very much. But I think I was probably fully formed. A fairly early period. By fully formed, I mean, to some extent, not all that mature either, but then I remained immature to that extent. Fully formed, yes, but I think that all the best things I've done in my life came late in life.
Came late in life?
Yes.
All the best?
Yes, all the best things.
Yeah. I mean, what except...
I was a late learner, for example.
Except learning and teaching?
Well, look, I was never head of any class in my school. Never. I was not a particularly good
sports
undergraduate. I was not.
Are you not particularly good at
it? Not particularly. I did quite well in the exam. I got it's called a bad first class, not a good one. I was rather idle by nature. I still am. All the work I've ever done, I've done because of shame, but not working. But I've never been addicted. I've never liked work.
And pressure of parents, pressure of your mother.
Certainly. Pressure of St. Paul's, which I went, was in school to overworked for. It's a sort of cramming establishment. But I think that, on the whole, my knowledge of people came late in life. Washington, for example, during the war, was a great liberating influence in my life.
I'm sure. I sensed it. And
certainly.
So
was also meeting all these powerful, important, and sometimes very unsympathetic politicians. Give an insight. Where England was governed, which was fascinating. About every 10 years of my life, I change what I do and become fascinated by something new. So that in a way, although I matured early, I then remained, as I say to myself, still impressionable, even now. Partly because I never became totally old. And I'm near, you see.
You never became totally old because you are prone to new impressions.
And I was never totally young.
And then you have never been totally
never
young.
I remained of an impressionable middle age of some sort.
Now, I got another impression telling you my...
In fact, I married so late in life.
Yes.
Itself is proof. I lived a monkish existence in all souls. Till a very late age. I felt no need to marry. Nobody ever thought I would. I felt absolutely... No inclination towards it.
Yes.
That you could regard as abnormal.
That's very interesting. Yes.
But it's part of what I'm saying.
Yes. You know, when I recollect our conversations, all what I read, you mention more of friends than teachers.
True.
More of, and I don't remember you mentioning, I mean, the teachers who really influenced you. You told me once or twice, I can't remember now. Austin was your age or older?
You're younger.
Even younger. I mean, I don't know whether you know, you repeat his name very often in our conversations.
I'm sure. No, you had a profound impact
yes.
on me.
Yes, but I never remember you telling me about the profound impact of one teacher or another.
I'll
and so many stories about your friends and even more stories about your students than about your teachers.
Could well be.
Did you have mentors?
Yes, I did. I had one very good schoolmaster, at St. Paul's, which is, of course, what makes all the difference. Not to begin with.
Yeah.
The masters who taught me at school between the age of, 13 when I went there, and the age of, 16, made no impact whatever, nor were they much good. Well, one or two of them better than others, more amusing, more stimulating. There was one schoolmaster who was taught Latin, who was very, terribly moved by literature, not necessarily the highest literature, who talked with a kind of spontaneous, sentimental eloquence. And that made a deep impression on me. So that when I began writing essays, which we had to do, about Greek literature, Latin literature, and so on, I could write with a certain degree of, uninhibited enthusiasm, which I would not have had if this man had not had a very liberating effect. The English in general, as you know, tend to repress rather than liberate. But this man talked in a rather, I wouldn't say inspired, but nevertheless, in some kind of liberating manner, in the sense that he talked in a very free, spontaneous, uninhibited way, about why he liked some poets more than others, what they were like, talked on modern criticism poetry. He wasn't very clever, he wasn't a great legendist, but he was a wonderful schoolmaster, in the sense that he made a deep impression by the sincerity and the rhetoric.
What was his name?
Matthews. He was a classical scholar from Balliol, long dead. That was the Balls. At Oxford, I don't think that anybody whose lectures I went to made a profound impression on me. My tutor at Corpus Christi College, who is 85 today, I mean now, this year, when I became president, called Hardy.
Huh?
Yes. He was, not something new. No, knew what Plato had sort of. Who was an infinitely scrupulous classical scholar, and who talked about one's essays sentence by sentence. His horizons went very wide, but his decency, sincerity, and his extreme intellectual sharpness had a real impact on me. One couldn't deceive him, one couldn't cheat, one couldn't get away with being eloquent, one couldn't write. So I've done it in my life, but he taught me this was not the thing to do. I do it, but I know perfectly well that one shouldn't. I admire those who don't. He was a censor in a way. He was a very nice man. I saw last night. But
85.
He was a famous guy. But he taught me about extreme scrupulous, extreme intellectual honesty, and extreme not going beyond what one knew to be supposed to be true. And no attempt at, as it were, getting away with it.
Yes.
By the use of words.
Yes.
In the way that French philosophers do, for example.
Which is very against the current.
It's against the modern current, certainly.
No, and the current...
My own suspicion of sociological pattern, psychological pattern, literary pattern, of the kind of general sort of, in a way, endless, so to speak, use of words, of a hypnotic use of words, comes from that. I think I would liable to it myself until I came under his influence.
But you have never mentioned.
Well, when what was the opportunity?
I don't know.
I've never read memoirs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I've never written about my life.
Yeah.
But that is true. Frank Hardy is the name, and I am a great deal. Except I do. Nobody except Austin at all I'm trying to think in All Souls. The only people more or less but also was my age. The only person senior to me was a man called Richard Bears, who again was a severe, stern, witty, rather man who never got away with anything. Ironical, who saw through things. He was very undeceived, intellectually undeceived. He was a superb scholar, a very austere kind. At the same time, imaginative, lively, and gifted. He had, that's the way to be. I admired that. The quality I did possess myself. But I admired it very much. I didn't have a neighborhood like that today. I always doubt it. It is not in my life. No models.
But in daily life as an undergraduate, I mean, you had your tutors, you had your lectures, nothing.
Quite nothing. Nothing transformed me, no. I drifted to being a tutor in philosophy simply by being interested in it.
Now, why
no Wittgenstein like Frege.
I know.
And no dream more like Frege. For the Bible talks with.
You see, Isaiah, you come from a Hasidic family, but you never had a rabbi. I mean, not on religious terms,
never.
Philosophical terms.
Never.
You would always rebel to a rabbi.
No.
To a Wittgenstein type, I believe.
Perhaps not. I might have fallen into some
of the... But there were some strong figures. Yeah.
No, I think you're wrong.
There were?
I think it was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you like...
I'm a natural Yerba worshiper.
I know, but not in your field. You admired Weizmann. I think in a certain period you transferred your attitude to Ben-Gurion. Maybe you wouldn't
Never.
Agree. You wouldn't agree. No. But you didn't worship a philosopher.
Because there was nobody in my world. These people existed, but I only read their books or their writings. For me, admiration had to be conjoined with some kind of personal influence. Although
yes.
It's not entirely true.
Oh, yes, that's what I mean.
It's not entirely true. It's true of Weizmann. It's true
I'm
of
sure in the arts you will find some people
certainly.
You admire.
Well, it was true of Toscanini, who was an absolute hero.
But you didn't know him personally.
It was true of him. No, I met him.
Oh, now
I knew. I had him conduct. At least I saw him conduct.
Why did Karajan deserve an article?
Deserve what article?
You wrote an article about Karajan.
I wrote a short article in The Observer.
I don't remember.
In The Observer, in 1949.
After the war. Yes.
49.
Well, I mean, he's the only
I can tell you exactly
living...
Why. I can tell you exactly why.
No, I mean, I
dislike
Karajan.
I dislike his conducting.
I know.
I admire it in a way. He's a man of some genius, but extremely unsympathetic to me. I wanted to go abroad in the summer of in all those years when I was only allowed to have about £20 foreign currency or £30. I couldn't live on that. So I managed to persuade somebody in The Observer to send me to Salzburg. In order to write an article about what I heard. Yes. That was the sole reason. 49 was probably the second year in which Karajan was allowed to conduct at all. But he had to be denazified for a long time. He conducted in Salzburg. I went with my friend Raimund von Hoffmannsthal, who was a friend of the famous Hoffmannsthal, who introduced me to Karajan personally. I took against him. I had him conduct at least 4 works in Salzburg that year. What I wrote about him was not quite what I wanted to say. If I'd been braver, I'd have said that his conducting was like that of a Nazi dive bomber, zeroing in on the object that is addressed not to the head, not to the heart, but to the nerves, which is what Trotsky said about Kerensky. What I said about him was sufficiently unfriendly for him to take notice of
it.
He then wanted to talk to me about it. I never took to him. No. I never admired him.
I know.
I mean, I admired him in a sense. I wrote the article simply in order to get the money to go abroad.
Yeah, that's why I didn't know. I mean, you didn't write about Toscanini. You didn't write
I didn't have to.
I never read it, by the way. I didn't come across it, but I saw it in the blog.
How do you know it? Yes. It was a very short piece in The Observer, simply to earn my money. Yes. About 200, 150 words. Not more. Short little article.
So, coming back to worshipping, and one can divide it between living and dead, of course. It's easier to admire.
The dead, of course,
yes. But, I mean...
Pasternak had that attitude towards, to some degree. To some degree.
After you saw him, or...?
After that. I'd hardly read him before. Yes, I didn't mean yes.
Now, I think...
Virginia Woolf had it towards. Was not at all nice about me.
I see. I think Stravinsky.
Yes.
I there was a period.
Certainly.
There was a period
certainly.
That he was always in your
certainly.
In your.
So it's certainly. Yes. Well, it's
but naturally you change your attitude of people. I mean, when I say Stravinsky, I can tell you that for 10 years I think I could follow you speaking very, very often about.
Quite right.
But, I mean, does it change through the years?
One forgets, yes. One forgets. It's true of Edmund Wilson. Towards my real value of Yoruba worship.
No. I read Edmund Wilson,
absolutely.
I don't agree.
Absolutely, I did, certainly.
I mean, it's more complicated. From your writings, it's more complicated.
You are talking about it in my article about him.
Yes.
That was jeu d'esprit. I just simply decided to write a rather irreverent article.
Yes, but still, I mean...
No. At the time, I was an absolute...
You wouldn't write at the time, but I see.
Maybe it was partly stimulated by the fact that he wrote not too nicely about me in his memoirs.
Yes,
in his letters, or his memoirs. So perhaps it's an act of revenge.
Now, you don't seem to have empathy or thought, let's say, French intellectual life nowadays.
Or at any time.
But not
or
in any time.
Well, finished,
but at least you wrote about French people, either positively or negatively.
Only about ideas, I think.
Yes, but why?
Not
about
literature.
What's the...
I don't know. I think I'm really good on East of the Rhine.
I have
more sympathy for Germans.
And Italy.
They have the French. Italy too. The French are too...
something you don't like about
something
France.
Something antipathetic, yes.
You don't visit France often.
There are something morally disagreeable about them to me. They're too dry. No, it's not the intellectuality. They're too dry and too... They have no heart. Balzac has no heart.
I agree.
Voltaire conspicuously had no heart. Rousseau, Swiss, he pretended to have a heart, but I doubt if he did. Maupassant had no heart. Even Flaubert. Heart is what they like. Brain, a nervous system, a great deal of intelligence, deep sensitivity, and genius. And deep understanding, very often.
But not among so many. I mean, I don't think that the deep understanding is on the part of the few. I'm heretic as regards...
Proust understood a very great deal. No heart.
No heart.
Not for me.
Yeah.
I may be wrong, but I call heart lacking. Those are the people I can't quite warm to. I admire them, I have nothing against them. I have never read a French novel which I have loved without qualification. Not standard. I love the standard novels, but not that much.
And did you ever have French friends in Oxford? Did you know Elia Levy?
I met him at lunch with Fisher.
And I'll tell you why I asked him. Because I was wondering whether you, the people like Elia Levy on the one hand, Vinogradov on the other hand, people who wrote about Britain with the insight of foreigners.
Quite.
They're very interesting.
Quite.
Did you have a special contact with this kind of people? I mean,
no. Well, Vinogradov was dead before I came. Uh-huh. Long
yes,
dead.
Yes, of course.
Died in 20s.
Yeah. No, I forgot that you came only in 28.
Yes, Vinogradov was long dead. I'm trying to think who they are. Alevi I never knew. I met. He spent his time in denouncing communism by that time, 1933. I really was great admiration. But I'm trying to think of very, very French friends.
In Oxford?
Evidently not.
We'll come to it later when we'll discuss if you have an attitude toward national character and so on, but not now. I mean, in your Oxford days...
I knew one or two of the French academics with whom I made friends, but not intimate friends, not people I talked to.
Yeah.
Partly because my French is so bad. This is
and you
truth.
Hate it. So. I mean, you can't...
No, I can't understand what they say.
It's not that you hate... That you can't express yourself?
No. I can't speak properly. I've never learnt it properly.
How come?
I just didn't. It's French at school. It's very bad.
And German? You went to Germany?
No, never. German, because I spoke German until the age of 3. My parents were bilingual in Russian and German.
Like many Riga people.
Was he? And the result, they went to German school. My mother went to German school in Riga. So it was closer. It was culturally closer. You see, not that my German is much good. I have to read the dictionary. Nevertheless.
Really?
Yes. I don't read it freely.
You devoted so much time to
French. I know. It takes a long time.
To German.
I read French more easily than German. I can read French quite well. German,
and
much more difficult.
And yet, you are more attracted by German.
Because of the whole culture of Eastern. Yeah. East of the Rhine means more to me. German, also, so to speak, the romanticism, the humanity. The Germans, funnily enough, do have hearts.
Do?
Have hearts.
Yes.
Goethe didn't, but the others did.
But in the 30s, didn't it, I mean, your
the Russians, of course, had maximal hearts.
Of course.
Turgenev, less than the others.
You told me once. I remember.
Tolstoy, not at all. That's all the matter.
But in the 30s, didn't the rise of Nazism and everything cause you didn't it deter you from dealing with German literature, culture, romanticism?
You mean not when Hitler was
about?
That's when I read my book in Karl Marx.
But Karl Marx...
It doesn't come to the Germans. Yeah. I don't think I did much. I didn't read Germans at that time. I did not. When I was at Oxford, I didn't read them very much. I read them a bit when I was a schoolboy, and a bit long afterwards. The last 10, 20 years. Who certainly told me I couldn't go to Germany for 20 years after war.
And yet you read so much about all the romantics.
No, I didn't.
I mean, even the obscure ones.
Listen, that I went to Germany. When did I first go to Germany? In the Bockhoff's opera, my friend performed in Köln, I had to go. Two offended if I hadn't. And what would that have been? 1960s, I think. Yes.
Now, what was the period that you dwelt so deeply
in
German romanticism?
I had German friends.
That I'm sure.
In the 30s,
yes.
Who came here, Rhodes scholars.
Many of them were Jews, probably.
No. Andrei Navjek is what I did not take to.
I know,
as you know.
I will tell you what.
What German Jews did I? The principal influence on me, intellectually, was by a Riga Jew called Rachmilevich. Nobody had great influence on me in my entire life. That you don't know about.
No.
You see? He was called Lempchen Rachmilevich. Solomon was his name.
Yeah.
He was the son of a Riga Jew who married a moderately rich wife, and he was a typical Russian Jewish social democrat. Let me tell you his life. He was born, I should think, in about 1890, perhaps. Maybe later. Since he was already 1880, actually. Let's say 1890. I think that's fine. Contemporary Pasternak. He was educated in Riga, in a German school, spoke Russian and German equally, was very Jewish, and he was a typical Menshevik, real Menshevik. He went to German universities. He went to Marburg, and he heard Hermann Cohen. He became a Kantian. He went to Heidelberg, he went to Bonn, he went everywhere, and was very adept in German philosophy. He read the whole thing, and read more. Great many German philosophers. He was intensely musical, could read scores very easily, which I could not do, and he read the whole of Russian literature. He was deeply Jewish. He understood Yiddish perfectly well. They didn't actually talk it to me, at least. But he used to go and talk to bearded workers outside Riga about the Social Democratic Congresses in Europe. Typical Jewish, Menshevik, agitator at that time. And tremendously highbrow, tremendous intellectual. I've never met a more intellectual man in my life. He read German poets. He, as I say, knew a great deal about music, musical theory, as well as music. I was the best educated man I ever knew. He came to nothing, as such people often do. I'll tell you a story about him if you'll see. When he was a schoolboy of 16, he went to Switzerland to meet Pekhalov. And he said to Pekhalov, what should I do to help the movement? Carano said, have you read Plato's Republic? He said, no. He said, have you read The Feeder? He said, no. Read those first, then come and see me again. He was terribly disappointed. He wanted to be given secret literature, spread among the workers, a weapon or something. He felt snubbed. But you can see this sort of thing. So he then did read The Republic and Plato, in fact. Then, during the war, he and his family were called Shalit. His mother was a relation of Shalit's. He's a rich Riga timber merchant. They went together to Constantinople, as they got to Russia. In Constantinople, he wandered about, until he got an English visa to about a month. He went wandering about Constantinople, found a nice garden, which he sat and read Eddington's last book on astronomy. He found around him people were sitting, didn't recognize them in oriental clothes. Suddenly there was silence and everybody looked at him. He realized he was sitting in the garden of a synagogue. They were all saying Tilim. It came to his turn. They thought what he had in front of him was a prayer book. He was very embarrassed. It was Eddington. Eddington, 19, was, you see what I mean, he really was up to date. Relativity theory he knew very well. And he, I think, even helped one of the Shalit brothers who translated Einstein into Yiddish in Berlin. Shalit had some intellectuals on him. And there were five brothers. One of them was quite a competent mathematician. Now, he then came to London and became a sort of assistant to Lippmann Shalit, who was the businessman in the family, made a lot of money. He studied British law in order to have use as a lawyer. I don't think he was ever any good at any business. He thought he was marvelous, in business he was not. Every afternoon on Saturdays at 1:30, 2 o'clock, he went to the British Museum where he read until 6. Steady, 4 hours every week. And he went to every concert there was. There's nothing he didn't know about conductors. If you went to a concert in the 20s, you would see him in the gallery, leaning forward prominently, watching every movement of a conductor. You could recognize him, even if you didn't know him, by the fact he stuck forward from the gallery. Money in our hand. Well, I met him because my parents were great friends of Shalit's. When I was a schoolboy, he talked to me about Kant.
To you?
Yes. And he talked to me about Brahms. And he talked to me about Marx. Not so much of Marx, too. Whenever I mentioned the name of an economist afterwards, he would say, that's a bourgeois economist. They always talked like the socialists. Bourgeois. Every time I mentioned a name, Keynes, bourgeois economist. Labeled. Then he taught me a great deal about music. Not so much opera, but symphonic music, quartets, and so on. He tried to teach me to read scores, but failed. And I used to see him as often as I could. He gave me the taste for intellectual life, for philosophy, for ideas. He was not a competent philosopher, but he knew exactly what the arguments were. He read every single British philosopher of note. He didn't like it very much. He told me what he didn't like about them. And his conversations with me were the most productive in my life, so far as sheer intellectual stimulation. Because he was a very nice man, charming, amusing. Talk about everything in the world in a purely amateur way.
You would go to him or
he would go to him? When I lived in London, I would go to him. He had a little room with books.
It was when you were at St. Paul's?
Afterwards. Mainly when I was at Oxford.
Ah.
Don.
Ah.
He came to see me as a don in All Souls too.
Ah.
When I was not a graduate.
Ah.
Afterwards at St. Paul's, I introduced him to all kinds of people. David Cecil liked him very much. Stuart Hampshire liked him very much. You see what I mean? They still remember him. Maurice Barra liked him less because he tried to talk preferably to Chinese, knocked him out the first blow. It was an easy thing to which I was careful not to do. He was not inhibited. He said he's a one-man demolition squad. And then during the war, he still went on in London. He became assistant of Michael Horobin, the 13th member of parliament,
yeah.
supplied him with pro-Zionist speeches. Although he was not a great Zionist himself, nevertheless the anti-Zionism of the anti-Zionists
irritated
him. So that he, Horowitz made an excellent speech once, and he also supplied material to, of all people, not very nice man really, Silverman.
Sidney Silverman.
He became a kind of intellectual supplier of speeches. He wrote those speeches. For example, he made a speech which began with the words, "Friends cannot betray one. Only enemies cannot betray one. Only friends can." It's a very good epigram.
Yeah.
You see, that is about the British British government. He will promise Palestine.
Yes, sir.
That was the theme. You see, then after the war, he went. I saw him quite a lot here, till about 1950. He then went to Israel, Palestine, perhaps even. Lived in Haifa, probably here, apropos of nothing. I saw him there. He was officially engaged in some kind of business, God knows what, printing, publishing. He then came back to London, and then finally went mad. He became a sex maniac, began writing letters to various women he knew, demanding their attention. He did nothing. Nothing ever happened. He never bounced to anyone. But he began writing mad letters, finally went off his head, and died very miserably. Brain fever and madness, he died very sad. Nobody admired him as much as I did. Nobody realized how marvelous he was. I was a disciple, I was not, but he contributed, I could talk to him about anything. Jewish matters, non-Jewish matters, anything we like. You see? He was brought up in a pious Jewish family in Riga. He was not a German Jew. I mean, he was a East European Jew,
Russian.
His grandfather was a late fiddler. His father died of drink, which is unusual. But his grandfather was a pious Jew.
Never tried to go to university?
He went to four German universities.
Did he?
I tell you, he went to Marburg, Kant. And neo-Kantianism.
Yes.
Nobody else ever talked to me about Hermann Cohen. Nobody else talked to me about Nathorp, about Emil Lusk, who was a Jewish philosopher. Kategorien der Kategorien. Nobody ever talked about all kinds of forgotten German philosophers and their ideas, which he spelled out very explicitly. He was completely clear. And nothing was ever obscure. And then we'd end up the evening, he would then play Hindemith to me, you see what I mean? This is the 20s, mind you.
Yeah.
Late 20s, when I was an undergraduate.
Yeah. Well, he
had views about composers and so on, you see. Russian music, he was not really interested. Stravinsky years, Bartok years. As I say, he was an absolutely unsurrendering highbrow. Well, he had a private life. He had no friends. He worked for Shalit. He was complete, fundamentally, hermit. And then these afternoons, what he called the British. The day I go to the British. Strong Russian accent.
And he wouldn't like to live in, he preferred England to Germany? I mean, to live?
Yes, sir. For some reason, I don't know why. And he spoke German perfectly. Perfectly.
You know,
no, he didn't like Germany. Didn't much like Germans. He knew no English. He knew a couple. I don't know how this came about during the war. He met these left-wing members of parliament. And he was still a social democrat to the end. He never ceased to be mentioned. Bourgeois economist.
You know that I believe that the best breed of Jews in the
country. Weizmann meant nothing to him.
Meant nothing.
None of the did. He just happened to be anti. He hated the English. He loathed the conservatives. He loathed the treachery and the hypocrisy and all the rest of it. You see, and he was surrounded by Zionists. All the Shalit sons, as they were.
Zionists.
One is still alive, I think. Leon Shalit.
Leon is still alive.
Still alive. Lionel's dead. Yes, but they have these relations.
I know.
He lived in that world. They called him Rach. Rach Milevich was the name. He was a cousin of
the surgeon?
First cousin.
The physician? He was a physician of genius.
I know. He was the first cousin.
I was going to ask him.
First cousin.
Now, I mean, Rachmilevich, the physician, is for me the example of what I always say, that the best breed of Jews in the 20th century are those with Russian background and German
discipline. He was educated in Germany.
I mean, all Jews who came, I think so.
He was.
Jews who came either from Russia or Lithuania and got their education in Germany are the
Lithuania
best.
Lithuania doesn't exist.
No.
Lithuania is
it's Russia. It's Russia.
Riga is less Russian than Lithuania.
I know.
Less. Yeah. There's some influence.
Yeah.
Some kind of.
Surely, I mean. When you look backwards to your life in Oxford, what was your attitude, if you can generalize, to emigres? I mean, except Russian, emigres. Intellectual emigres. Except
such
Russians.
As who? You mean Mannheim or Germans?
You can start with Eduard Frankel and finish with Kolakowski. I mean, take the Russian side.
I had no general attitude towards them. Russian emigres were Jews, the ones I knew, like my family. That is quite natural.
And you liked them even if they were not Jews?
I didn't know any non-Jews.
Nabokov was.
That's after the war.
Yeah, I mean, I told you, only long your life.
Russians had natural affinity too, which had nothing to do with being emigres.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Others.
I could have done equally well with them in the Soviet Union.
That's what I thought.
Others. Others. Germans.
And it's a provocative question.
Certainly.
Because I don't met many friends, emigre friends of yours.
Not quite so. No, I know what you mean. I realize that the question, I'm just trying to think, who were friends of mine among the German emigres?
Or others.
Well, who else were emigres?
I told you, from the early days to the days of Kolakowski and the Poles.
Poles are very late.
Yes, I mean...
Wait a bit. Germans, above all. Kassira, Dr. Wiesengold, daughter. I didn't know very many. Did I have friends among them? Did I like them? No.
Yeah,
I didn't like... I mean, it's impossible to say I didn't like German Jews. Because... have I ever liked a German Jew very much? Joseph Cohen. He was a very harmless man.
Yeah, I didn't know him.
Very harmless man. I felt perfectly
And a delightful man, apparently.
No.
No?
He was frightfully boring.
And you still like...
I got on very well with him. He was with Weizmann.
Because of Weizmann.
He was honest. Decent, honest, terribly boring, but touching. Certainly had a heart. But he was a real, tremendous bore. I mean, heavy, slow, but incapable of cheating. That's why Adenauer liked him. Gave him all that money. Got him money for the Weizmann Institute.
Yeah.
All the German professors liked him. Because he was so Deutsch. He might have a problem with it. I'm trying to think. German Jews were friends of mine. An American novel, isn't it? It's not true.
There was a professor here now of German literature, for example.
You mean Prava?
No, yes. The other one. Who was a friend of Hermann Karr.
No, he never got on
with
him.
Never got on with him, you see.
No, because he didn't want to be a Jew. I mean, partly because he was terribly anxious.
I don't know.
He was completely concealed. Yeah. Ganz.
Ganz. You know that he's one of the closest friends of Hermann Karr?
I do indeed. Because he went to see him in Germany before the war.
Karr's father sent him to affidavit.
Well, because he stayed with him before the war.
Exactly.
I know the story too. Yeah. Raymond told me.
I think I told
you
too.
You may have told me too. No, I never liked him very much. Yeah. Quite a nice man. Yeah. I'm trying to think.
I'm like the scientist. I don't know. I mean, you had Hans Krebs, Nobel Prize. You have now.
Look, I knew Krebs.
No, but
great
I mean,
they were not friends.
No, that's it.
They
couldn't
be.
I know. I think
they couldn't be. I could be more friends with Germans than German Jews. My two German friends were von Trott, who was a genuine friend, and a man called, who just died, called, what was his name? From one of my best friends. He was a German Rhodes Scholar in 1938-39, went back to Germany, was a doctor. went to the Eastern Front and left Germany in 45, because the end of 45, beginning of 46, because there's two Nazis in it. Still, after the defeat, couldn't take it. So he went to Sacramento, and Menuhin looked after him. He was a friend, he played the violin. His name was... Well, it's very German. He came from the same town as Hindenburg, even Neudeck. With Junker.
Kenigsberg? Proper Junker. Kenigsberg?
What?
From Kenigsberg?
Neudeck.
Neudeck.
That's where Hindenburg came from.
East Prussia?
Exactly. East Prussia, yes. His name was...
Well, it will come to you.
The name like Hasso and Bodo and...
I'll remember to ask you next time, so don't worry. And let's say people like Momigliano, like...
Much better.
Much better.
Italian Jews I can do. I'm sure that if I'd known Levi,
Primo Levi,
I could have made friends. I could have made friends with him. I could. Momigliano I did make friends with. Kolakowski too. Much easier for me than German Jews. Kolakowski, I feel no barrier at all. I don't see him very much, which I regret, because I don't see anybody very much. But I feel absolutely easy in his presence. And I understand his mode of thought and everything. You see, Walitzki, I had a friend who is now in Notre Dame.
But I think that on the whole, you didn't have many immigrant friends. I mean, not
well, how many? There weren't many.
I mean, Kolakowski is not your friend. I mean, he.
I like him very much.
Yes, all right.
I like him. He's not an intimate friend. No.
You know that one of my.
Who are Kolakowski's friends in England? There are none.
I don't know.
I mean, Luke Bellard, Montefiore.
Are they?
My great friends, yes. Yes, sure, kids.
Kolakowski always reminds me, by the way, of Dolokhovitz. I mean, they have the same.
I understand. But since marriage, one loses friends anyway. If I'd been a bachelor,
yes.
Far easier to make friends.
You know that my lesson from my long life in Oxford, Wilkinson, was that I shall never want to be...
But I get very exhausted when I talk. That's my only thing.
No, I'm
here.
Continue.
I'm trying to think about the emigre. It's amusing. Cassiera couldn't have been a friend. Wiesinger the Donner was a comical figure to me. I knew him very well.
I think that you won't like said emigres. I mean, the said...
No, only German Jews.
Only German Jews.
Germans, all right.
Maybe the others were not that said. I mean...
Give me an example of the emigres.
I know people...
I get around very well with Gombrich, for example. But he comes
he's a Viennese and he's a Jew.
Certainly. Well, his parents... He's baptized, of course. But his wife is Jewish. Yeah. And his father
why did Noel Annan write in his last article?
Papa, typical refugee. Karl Popper.
He's not your friend.
No, but nobody is.
Yeah, except
Gombrich. But I like him more than German Jews.
Why did Noel Annan write in his last article that next to Kenneth Clark, Anthony Blunt was the best art historian and he didn't mention Gombrich? Or he thought on your
he's
British?
He's wrong.
Or did he thought on your British?
He wasn't all that
wrong. It's in his last article.
I know. Well, which one? About Blunt. Which was it? Two, but...
A few days ago.
The very last.
The very, very last.
I haven't read it yet, but... No, the last article
the,
by
the one before was excellent.
Last article by him is about Hillman's Book and Wild. In the current Observer.
I'm still not done the other review.
Observer ago.
And the one before in the New York Review of Books on Spycatcher...
Yes.
...was superb.
Very good indeed.
Superb.
Very good.
It's the first time I was prompted to write him.
I'm
going to phone him because I never thought of...
Always a pleasure.
I mean...
Absolutely excellent.
Superb.
New York Review.
Yes.
Very good. I must get rid of the Observer a week ago because...
I'll get...
You don't get it, yes. Because I didn't think I read that. That was a review of the book about Blunt, which I never read. That's one I haven't read.
You have got a tome probably the New York
Review. Last Sunday. That was the Observer.
The Observer was Oscar Wilde.
This week.
Yes.
Today.
On Blunt it was in the New York Review of Books.
No, that's Spycatcher.
No, there is a new issue of New York UFOs.
Problem C.
Just out. And there is not
right.
yet a very
isn't
long article on Blunt. Less
right.
good.
Isn't it right?
Less good. Too long. There are very nice points there. But the one on Spycatcher was Schindler.
He admires Kenneth Clark too much, and he admires Blunt too much.
Yes,
Kenneth Clark, he thinks,
there.
Was a genius. He was not.
It's there. It's there.
He's wrong about both.
Yeah,
he knows nothing about art history.
Yeah, well,
he goes by opinions, Cambridge opinion.
Yeah, about Noel Lennon, we'll discuss in one of our next episodes, because I know him. Whenever he comes to Israel, he comes to
I'm trying. He likes German refugees, I'm sure.
Yes.
He likes German
yes.
Jews.
Yes.
He does. He married one
he
of
married
them.
Oh, she's a kid.